So it is going to be a talk on, it's really a program evaluation of Ontario's mass immunization program in response to H1N1. I guess before I start, I just want to introduce myself. So I'm now a health economist with Ontario Agency for Health Protection and Promotion. At the time this work was done, as part of my PhD, so I'm also completing a PhD at University of Toronto, so it's got nothing to do with the agency. I also would like to thank my co-authors. It's a really great, great group. So it's been a lot of fun. And Maria and Chris are in the back of the audience. Paper has been published now. And I think what I want to do with this talk is mainly, focus on the economics. I will talk a little bit about the model. I think I would like to show you that economics is not only about cost, that it's a lot of fun, and that it's worthwhile to do it and add it on to whatever transmission modeling you're doing. Motivation. This was, other than my PhD and the completion of my PhD, this was a huge motivation. Basically getting all this bad press talking about cost and that costs are increasing, that the mass immunization program is going to cost way more than it was ever anticipated to cost. And so kind of this one-sided focus on cost, and nobody talked about effectiveness. And so part of the motivation was to bring some, to do some objective work kind of inform this whole discussion. So the objective was to estimate the cost effectiveness of the mass immunization program in response to the pandemic H1N1 influenza 2009 outbreak in Ontario, compared to no immunization program from the perspective of the healthcare payer. And I'm going to explain some of this terminology later, so don't worry. Just some background in terms of methods. So what we've done is called cost effectiveness analysis, which means we take into account the cost and the effectiveness. So we are comparing two different options. One option is to immunize the population, and our comparator was not to immunize the population. And so we are looking at the additional cost of the program. We are looking at cost savings, assuming you're preventing cases, and we're looking at health outcomes. It's done from the healthcare payer perspective, which in Ontario is the Ministry of Health. So every resident of Ontario has health insurance or is insured under this provincial program. So this would basically cover the immunization program and any treatment costs come out of the same budget. So I think that's something to take into account if you want to extrapolate to other jurisdictions. Our primary health outcome, we use quality-adjusted life years. So this is an economic concept that takes into account quality of life and quantity of life. So say if you have influenza or any other kind of disease and without the treatment, this is the quality and length of life, so this over time, and then your quality of life is rated on a scale between 0 and 1, where 0 means death and 1 is perfect health. So now you get a treatment, you improve your quality of life because you're feeling better. And then depending on this disease, you may also prevent death, so you're extending your life over time. And so this quality-adjusted life is just a composite measure of those two concepts. And we like to use it in economic evaluation because you can apply it to any type of disease. And that makes different interventions very comparable. As I said, so the second health, or the second outcome or cost, because it's the perspective from the healthcare payer, we are including direct costs, which are related to the program and to the treatment. So this is mainly medical costs. So we are not including things like time lost because you go and get the vaccine or time lost because you're sick. And then the final outcome would be a cost per quality gained, which is the incremental cost effectiveness ratio, or ICER, in the equation above. And so this is basically what you have to pay to get one additional year of perfect health or one additional unit of health outcome. And so this whole economic evaluation is pretty much based on prediction of a simulation model of the pandemic outbreak in Ontario. And that had been published in summer last year, pretty much a year ago now. And we have updated it for this evaluation. So this model really is kind of a representation or like a virtual world of our communities. It's very simplified because it captures only the things that we are interested in terms of transmission. So obviously we have people in the model that live in households. that live in communities, and then children will go to school and adults will go to work. So we have different locations for the people that they're assigned to. So the different model components or the demographics, so what I just mentioned, the different locations, people that are assigned to different places and spending time throughout the day at these different locations. And then on an individual level, we have the typical kind of SIR type model. So people are susceptible, they get infectious, they may have symptoms or not. In our model, we consider treatment. Some people may get treatment because that was part of the plan, also was not the focus of this evaluation, and then recovered, and some people may get vaccinated or not. So this is all part of this individual level situation. And then so basically we introduce or seed the virus in the community, and we let the virus spread in the model and get the epidemic curve. So this is a stochastic individual-based model. It's got a structured population of about 10,400 individuals, which is based on the demographic profile of London in Ontario. So that's a medium-sized typical city in Ontario. We've got altogether 7 age groups, so preschool children, 3 age groups for school children, 2 age groups for adults, and then older adults, or say 3 age groups for adults. And a couple of different locations, as I mentioned already, so home, then depending on age, daycare, school, or work, and the community at large. Probability of infection depends on the number of contact and the per-contact transmission probability. So number of contacts in turn depend on how much time you spend in different locations per day. So during a typical weekday, we assign people to spend 4 hours at home, 8 hours at school or work, and 2 hours in the community. And that changes during the weekend. People don't go to work, so they spend more time at home and more time in the community. And if people get sick, they will withdraw from home, so from work to home. So some of them, not all, for a couple of days. Then contact preferences are homogeneous in households, and they're age stratified in all the other locations, and that's what's shown in the contact matrix, which is the modified gamma distribution. And so the contact frequency per hour are highest in households, classrooms, and daycare groups. They are lower in workplaces and schools, especially outside the classroom. So if in school they have 7 hours of classroom time and 1 hour of recess, and then it's lowest in the community at large. I think that's fairly standard. So transmission probability depends on the susceptibility of susceptible individuals, which in turn depends on whether they have been vaccinated or not. And infectivity depends on the infection status, so pre-symptomatic, symptomatic, asymptomatic, whether they get antiviral treatment or not, and whether people were vaccinated or not. So putting that all into the model, we calibrated it to match primarily the reported number of hospitalizations, ICU admissions, and deaths. And that's because we find this data much more reliable than lab-confirmed cases. So we wanted to first match it to this reported numbers of events, even though we know that they're most likely underreported. Secondarily, we also wanted to predict plausible symptomatic attack rate. So we didn't want to be completely off, obviously. So in the left chart, so you see the calibration towards the healthcare resource use and death, and then on the right hand you see kind of the lower and upper confidence intervals and the mean of symptomatic cases that we had estimated from hospitalized cases, and then the red line is the model prediction, so it's right in the middle. So strategies, as I mentioned, so we want to compare the Ontario program to no intervention. Ontario program started end of October. This was about two weeks before the pandemic peak. And we first vaccinated high priority groups for 2 weeks, and then it was expanded, and then eventually everybody was able to get H1N1 vaccination. The coverage data that we used for this analysis that was published at the time we did it said that 45% of the population was vaccinated by the end of January in 2010, and we assume that it takes 2 weeks to develop immunity. So this is what came out of the transmission model. So we got the epidemic curve with the immunization program, that's the blue one, and without the immunization program, that would have been the red one. And I think I would like to stress here that contrary to how we usually do economic evaluations, so usually you kind of have your standard treatment now, then you get a new treatment and you have some randomized controlled trial and you predict how it would be effective in the population. This time this was the other way around. So we kind of had data on how the pandemic played out with the intervention. So this was with the vaccination program. So that's why we calibrated the model the way we did. And then you take the vaccination out and you kind of see what happens if that would not have been implemented. So having the number of cases, basically it's just really like linear extension. So there's some probability that events occur. And these events are physician office visits, emergency department visits, hospitalizations, if somebody is hospitalized, whether or not they will be admitted to an ICU, if they are in the ICU, whether they will be put on mechanical ventilation and or extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, which is like a very high level of rescue therapy that's usually not used at all, other than in heart surgery. And this seemed to be a bit of a problem in some provinces. So we tried to be model very careful this kind of events happening in an ICU. And death if hospitalized. So this makes implicitly the assumption that nobody died outside the hospital. And so as you can see, the highest probabilities, 19%, was for a physician office visit. So if somebody is symptomatic, then 19% would go and see a physician. Only 5% would go to an emergency department visit. And less than 1% would be hospitalized, and out of those, few will get all the special therapies. And as I mentioned already before, so our main outcome was quality-adjusted life years. So basically, for the mortality part, if somebody dies now, we kind of used the life expectancy of how long that person would have lived if they would not have died because of influenza. And we used this utility rate that's, as I mentioned, between 0 and 1. So this is the quality loss, and that is approximately 5 to 10 days of healthy life loss for a case of influenza. And of course, you have to add cost. Main costs really are the immunization program, and it was really, really expensive, especially if you compare it to the seasonal program. So we found that public immunization in Canada, or in Ontario specifically, was mainly delivered through public health units. So let's say during the seasonal flu, they get reimbursed $5 per person vaccinated. So now they kind of added up all the costs and seem to be more like $20 per person vaccinated. Then the vaccine, we looked at a couple of different scenarios. This is because Canada ordered enough doses to cover 75% of the population with two doses each, and it cost approximately $8 per dose. So now we didn't use that much. And then there was a provincial federal cost sharing program. So in the base case analysis, we assumed that the provinces could not just give back the doses that they didn't need. So we need to pay for everything, whether we used it or not. But that the cost sharing is in place, so the province paid only $320. We did sensitivity analysis on all the other combinations or possibilities, and I just want to say that it didn't change much. So this was about $60 million for the vaccines only. And then, of course, you've got the cost, and it's almost opposite to the probability. So most people go and see a physician in the office, which is kind of the low-cost treatment, and if you go down to the very high-level procedures, they are, like, really, really expensive. So results. So you've got a number of cases. So we estimated that in Ontario, which has a population of 13 million, would expect 4 million cases without the program and 3 million cases within the program, which is a reduction of 1 million cases. And so obviously, if you reduce the number of cases, you reduce everything else. So you have fewer people that go to hospital, fewer people that go to an ICU, fewer people that die. And that translates into costs saved to the healthcare system. So the immunization program, all in all, we estimated it cost $180 million, but only $30 million could be saved by preventing cases, which means it's still a net cost of $150 million. So I think that's also a very important distinction to make. So cost effective doesn't mean cost saving. So we still have an additional cost. So all in all, immunizing 45% of the population prevented almost 1 million cases, reduced healthcare costs from 180 to, that should be high, by 30 million. So, and we gained 17,000 additional qualies. And so this incremental cost effectiveness ratio came out at about 8,000 per quality gained. And to put this into perspective, this would be considered highly cost effective under WHO thresholds, which uses the GDP of a country. So if it's below the GDP for your country, then that's per capita, which is 39,000 in Canada, then that's highly cost effective. If it's below three times that threshold, then it's still considered cost effective. So we looked at all kind of sensitivity analysis, basically varying all the parameters in the model, and it seems to be really, really robust. Results almost sensitive to the timing of the program, less sensitive to the immunization program costs and qualities. We also did a probabilistic analysis, which basically means we sampled from distributions for all the values in the model, and it sure came out. We did 1,000 simulations, and it still came out to be cost effective in all the simulations if we used a threshold of 25,000 per quality gained, which is even lower than the WHO threshold for cost effectiveness. So this is just a graph of showing or listing all the variables. We varied them over their range and how much the incremental cost effectiveness ratio is affected. So the ones on the top are the ones that the model is most sensitive to. And as you would imagine, the timing is the most critical thing. And we did 2 weeks introducing the program 2 weeks before or 2 weeks later than it was actually implemented. And even implementing it 2 weeks later is still very cost effective. And this is the 1,000 simulations from the incremental cost effectiveness ratio. So basically you have on this axis costs of the this immunization versus without immunization. So you have additional costs, but you also have an additional health gain. And so all the dots are the 1,000 simulation, and everything that's below the red line would be considered cost effective. So in this, for discussion, find that our results were consistent with what we usually find for seasonal influenza, even though timing is really important. On the other hand, effectiveness is much higher for this type of very good, well-matched vaccine as compared to the seasonal influenza. We found that Ontario had implemented the program just in time to be really, really cost-effective, even so it was too late to change the epidemic curve considerably. So even on my graph, it looks like a lot, but that's because of the scale. So if I scale it up, you barely see it, actually. And so most quality gain could be attributed to preventing non-fatal cases because mortality was so low and was a rather mild pandemic. As a limitation, we did not include vaccine-associated adverse events because there wasn't much literature on it at the time we did the analysis. So in conclusion, this analysis suggests that the mass immunization program in response to H1N1 2009 carried out in Ontario was effective in preventing influenza cases and was also highly cost effective despite the very, very high program cost. Thank you.